Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here, as usual, when we're talking physics with Russ Chianelli as co-host. And today we're going to be talking about nuclear physics. Now, that sounds pretty erudite, but we've got a guide for nuclear physics, the theoretical part of it anyway, and his name is Jørn Randrup. He's from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. That's in California, just outside of San Francisco, in fact, Berkeley. And Jørn, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here.
We have a lot of people out there that are... We like to tell them how you got interested in physics, theoretical physics.
Yeah. Or science
when you were a kid.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say it was a bit by accident I came into that. You know, you have to try to make some decisions when you're done with high school about that time. And I didn't know I was interested in many things, I think, as kids are in high school. So what should I do? I looked at many, many different things, and I had reasonably good grades in this and that. So a little bit by chance, and because some friends did that, I decided, well, let me study math and physics. Why not? And then see what happens. Then it turned out that this was a very overwhelming job to do that. This was completely overwhelming. So in this way, I got pretty soon changed from being very broad to being just focused on that because there simply wasn't time for anything else. And then little by little, you know, after a few years, you had to choose between math and physics. My friend chose math. I chose physics. I thought it was a little more interesting to deal with the actual world than just the abstract. And then, so this is how I finally got a degree in physics.
Where did you get your degree from?
Well, from the University of Aarhus in Denmark. There were at that time two universities, the University of Copenhagen that had existed for many hundred years, and then a relatively new one in the provinces, close to my hometown, and that's where I went. That was the natural thing, just 25 miles down the road.
So did you stay at home and commute?
No, I didn't. I rented a room with a family, basically, and that was common to do that.
Okay.
That was, I mean, relatively primitive, but that was all right. But the thing is then that there was no real advising at that time. Nobody advised us in high school. Nobody had advised us in the university. And if there had been an advisor, the advisor would probably have told me that it would not have been such a great idea to study theoretical nuclear physics at that university, because Copenhagen was the world center for that at the time, and they had got one Nobel Prize after another and so on. But nobody told me that, so I studied it there. And at some point I found out that this was not such a great idea. I had to advise myself, basically, and so on. So I decided the thing to do was to finish as soon as I could and get out of there. And so I finished a year early, and then I had still money, 1 year money, so I could go basically where I wanted.
So the system was that
I had a stipend for
3 years
or
whatever.
Something. Yeah,
I got it.
And they
let you keep it. That's clever.
Yeah, they were happy to do that. Not so many people did go abroad, but they were very happy or very supportive about that. And I wrote around if I could come, and you tend to be fairly welcome if you bring your own money. So I could have gone to MIT and could go to Berkeley, other places, and a little bit by chance I chose Berkeley. So this is how I originally got in contact with Berkeley. So a little by chance.
Then it turned, but it's by an act of will, too. You wanted out quickly, and you knew you'd have a year's money, and you could – that was very clever.
Because, you know, I realized since there was really nobody there, it's a great place and they did very well. But they very wisely decided that they should not try to compete against Copenhagen in that field. They should make their own profile, and they did, marvelously. They're a very highly ranked university. Anyway, so that's how I originally got hooked up with Berkeley. I didn't stay there, but this is how I made that, got into
it. So
that
your PhD was then from Berkeley, is what we're talking
about? No, the PhD was from Aarhus. I got my PhD.
Oh, I see, you got everything from there.
I got my PhD, and then I left.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So you did a postdoc, so to speak.
Exactly, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
But then you came back now. You're a faculty member associated with the Lawrence Berkeley National...
Yeah, I mean, it was a little back and forth because... When I was in Berkeley, then they offered me actually a real postdoc for 2 more years. So I was there for 3 years, and then I went back to Denmark. But then I went to Copenhagen. Then I was there for 3 or 4 years, and then I started to look around for a job, and by chance there was an opening in Berkeley. There were not many openings in those days. There were many people, and I think it helped me that they knew me. So it was a tough competition, but I was lucky. So then I went back to Berkeley, and that was how I wound up there. So that worked out well.
Well, let me ask you, here you are in El Paso. You're not very far from the site where the first nuclear bomb went off.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever visited the site?
Oh, yes, I visited there, yeah. Actually, just a few months after I came to Berkeley, I visited there because I happened to share office with a guy from Sweden, and he was spending half a year there with his professor, and then he was going to go to Los Alamos. So I drove with him before, you know, over Christmas, and we visited several places on the way, including there. So we visited the place. I didn't find the place as such particularly significant, but I knew, of course, about the bomb and had read a lot about it.
There was a beautiful book that I read as a student. Yeah. It was by a Swiss gentleman. I can't remember his name, but it was called Brighter Than a Thousand Suns.
Oh, yes, that's right.
It's a very important book. Yeah. It gives a very good history of how it developed.
Of course, the history of the scientists that went out there and escaped from Germany and all that kind of stuff is just fascinating to me.
Yes, that's right, that's right. But I should say maybe, that when you do theoretical nuclear physics, at least what I have done, this is really it's not really concerned with bomb making or with energy production. We are interested in basic things. How are nuclei really composed? Their structure, their contents. You know, nuclei are made of nucleons, and nucleons themselves are made of quarks.
Yeah.
So that's what we're interested in. Nothing you can really use for anything in a way.
Except you did say at the beginning of the program that you thought math was too abstract, and so you wanted to do something in the real world, and you choose nuclear physics. Most of us know the nucleus as protons and neutrons, you know, and then we begin to understand that there are other things that are sort of being developed. Why don't you give us a very quick history, if you like, over our understanding, more likely your understanding, of what a nucleus is?
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, so in fact, when my daughter went to elementary school, the science teacher, they had a very enthusiastic, a good science teacher, and he asked me every year to come and give a lecture on nuclear physics to the seventh graders.
That's what we need now.
So this is the kind of thing, because they don't know much of the technical stuff and so on. So that's very interesting, and it's not so difficult to understand the basics of it. You know, nucleons nuclei are the things that hold the atoms together. They sit in the middle of the atom. They're very heavy, they're very small, they have a positive electric charge that holds the electrons in orbits. And then the nuclei themselves, they are composed, as you say, of nucleons. There are two kinds, protons and neutrons. And they are, you can put them together, the simplest nucleus is just a single proton, has one charge, and therefore the neutron atom has one electron, that's a hydrogen atom. And then you can build them together. The nucleons, I tell the kids, are like people, they like to stick together a little bit, so you can put two nucleons together, three nucleons. And they have also the property that the attractive force is stronger between the different kinds than the same kinds, like, let's say, between boys and girls, or men and women, rather than. So therefore, nuclei tend to have more or less equally many neutrons and protons. So that's when you see the nuclear chart, it's like a sort of peninsula going up to the right. But because the protons have a charge, they repel each other like the alpha males do. So in the end, there will be more neutrons than protons in the nucleus. And this is a disruptive force. And finally, there's a limit to how big you can make a nucleus. When you make them very, very big, there's so many protons that it's very easy to break the nucleus apart. You agitate it a little bit and it splits. Then you have nuclear fission. And this is the mechanism that gave rise to the bomb you mentioned, because then you get these two smaller nuclei coming out. They repel each other due to the electric force. You get a tremendous energy out of that. But anyway, nowadays the frontier is at the deeper level, that the nucleons themselves are not elementary particles, it was found out. They themselves consist of something we call quarks. There's three quarks in each one. And they're very peculiar particles because you can't take them out individually. It's like a magnet. If you have, nowadays we don't see it so often, but a bar magnet. If you cut it in two, you don't get one North Pole and one South Pole. You get two smaller bar magnets. You create a pair of poles, so to speak, when you cut. And the same with quarks. If you try to pull, you make another pair. So you get, you know, a quark antiquark and a quark antiquark instead. So anyway, so these particles are difficult to study. And this is, you know, where the frontier is. And we try to study them in various ways. And this is the kind of area I have been involved in a lot through my career.
You know, out in there, and things like muons and gluons and things of this nature.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is a further sort of investigation and a separation of a bigger unit to smaller ones.
Yes, that's right.
So is there any rationale that says to you from the theoretical basis that you come from that this is an ever proceeding process, that we're always going to be cut and divide, like the British did with the empire, right? Just divide and rule, divide and rule.
This is a good question, and we don't know the answer to that. There are indeed theories for what about the quarks? Do they consist of smaller parts or what? These are so far only theories. We do not know. And it is hard enough to study the quarks because they never come out in isolation, so it's very difficult.
What about bosons?
Well,
where do they come from?
Well, there is a general classification that the level elementary particles, you can put the particles in different boxes like in a diagram, and the elementary particles come in two kinds, bosons and fermions. And basically, the particles I mentioned are fermions. This is named after the famous physicist Fermi. It has to do with something called the Fermi exclusion principle that says you can only, a given state can only be occupied by one particle at a time.
The cat in the box.
But the forces between the particles are conveyed by bosons. So the photon that conveys the electromagnetic force is a boson. The graviton that conveys the gravitational field is a boson. And the nuclear force is conveyed primarily by pions, and they are bosons, and other mesons, heavier, all many names, the rho meson, the omega meson, the whole Greek alphabet. And for the quarks, they are
Have they got to
particles.
An omega?
Oh, yes.
So what comes next?
The one I mentioned was a lowercase omega, but they're also capital. That's a different story. But the quarks themselves are also fermions. They're particles, and they're held together by something called gluons. And for lack of a better name, it just conveys the idea that it glues these bosons glue the quarks together. So very much like a photon, except the difference is that the photon, the electromagnetic radiation, does not have charge itself. It makes charged particles attract or repel each other, but the individual photon doesn't have a charge. The gluon has a charge, and this makes this whole physics at that level much more complicated. You could even have something called glue balls, where there are no quarks at all, just made up of gluons themselves because they interact with each other. So this is a possibility that is as yet unverified, but that's the kind of thing where the frontier is nowadays, to look for these sort of things.
But this is a theoretical frontier. There's not too many experiments, I suspect.
Well, there are many experiments, and they are, you know, it requires big facilities, and they are kind of two directions you can go. You can try to it's a little bit like an electric microscope. You accelerate an elementary particle like an electron to a very high energy, and then you shoot it on a proton or something. And there's a facility here in the U.S. at the Jefferson Lab where they do something like that. So this is a little bit like to look at what is there. Another kind of approach.
And by looking at what is there, they're really looking at what comes off.
Well,
when
that's
that
correct.
Sort of interaction takes place.
This is correct, and they try to find out. You know, it is a big puzzle because the proton itself has what is called a spin. It means an angular momentum. it kind of rotates, but like the Earth. But now, since it consists of quarks, and there also must be gluons there, you can ask, well, how much of the spin is carried by quarks, how much by gluons? And this is very puzzling. And this is a big issue. And you can try to study that by shooting on and, of course, measuring what comes out and try to figure out what it means.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And today our guest is Jørn Randrup from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And we're talking about nuclear physics and all those wonderful names, gluons, etc., etc. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. A mere millennia ago, the average human died in their 20s. And just a century ago, people only expected to live into their 40s.
Today, the average American has a lifespan of nearly 79 years. That's nearly doubling our longevity in just over a century.
Biomedical research and regenerative medicine will only lengthen our lives further. But how far? We won't know unless we understand the causes of aging.
A widely accepted theory of aging is evolutionary senescence, which means as we age, damage accumulates in our DNA. Then cells are less able to replicate properly and regenerate tissue.
In fact, most everyone is familiar with the term free radical, which shows how damage to our cells over time contributes to aging. Cells produce free radical molecules when they use oxygen to make energy. Free radicals lead to oxidative damage of DNA and other cell components.
Even though we have protective genes in place to kill off damaged cells, those same processes may also play a role in aging. An often used example concerns a gene called P53. As we age, it may become excessive in its role of directing damaged cells to die so that tissues don't regenerate and atrophy.
Our neuroendocrine system may also affect aging and involves hormones. For example, in studies with lab mice, lowering IGF or insulin-like growth factor extended their life.
Ancient philosophers believed we're born with a predetermined amount of vital force, and when it's used up, we die. It's more complex than that, but could we eventually replenish our life force? We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Jørn Randrup from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And we're talking about nuclear physics. Russell, I know you've got all sorts of questions there.
What about the God particle? What is it, and did we actually find it?
Yeah, this is really not nuclear physics. And this is what they call high energy physics. We have found the Higgs.
The Higgs boson.
And this is, I shouldn't say we, because it's the high energy physicists who have found it. They have definitely found it. They have found many, many thousands. They are doing careful measurements on it now. So that's a well-established thing. But it's a little bit of a miss, what should I say, maybe an advertisement to say that the Higgs particle is responsible for all mass. This is what you usually read. But this is not quite true. It is because of that particle that the quarks have a mass. They have a small mass. They are not completely massless. For many years we thought they were massless. They have a small mass. That the electron has a mass. But the nucleons, they have a much, much larger mass. And this is not due to the Higgs. This comes from the gluons. Because the quarks themselves have hardly any mass, so you put three of them together, you don't get very much mass. But the gluons that bind them together, they generate somehow the mass. So by far, most of the mass we see in the universe has nothing to do with the Higgs at all. Still, it's a very fundamental particle, and it's the last piece of the puzzle in the so-called standard model.
Yeah.
So that's very important.
So that's why it's called the God particle, simply because it was the capstone of an arch.
I don't want to explain or defend. I think it's an unfortunate term because it's generated a lot of misunderstandings.
Okay.
It's always dangerous.
I retract the question. I'll go to Google.
You're talking about the nucleus and atoms and so on. Well, they formed in the universe somehow.
Yeah, yes,
and there's
yes.
There's all kinds of questions about how we got this distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was another
sun,
would the distribution be the same?
Yeah. So, I mean, let me just say, the other way you can investigate the composition of protons and the quarks and gluons is by simply slamming nuclei together at high energy. It's called high-energy heavy ion physics, and this is the area I have worked in. That also requires accelerators. We have a big one in the U.S. At the Brookhaven National Lab called the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. And then when you slam these two gold nuclei together at very high energy, the nucleon simply melts and you get a giant volume full of just quarks and gluons, more or less roaming around freely. Now they're no longer confined to be in the nucleons because it's like a big bag of quarks and gluons. And it's called the quark-gluon plasma. And this is a state of matter that existed very shortly after the Big Bang, when everything was very hot and dense. So we can learn about the quarks and the gluons and also relate this to the early evolution of the universe, and also related to how conditions are in big stars, stars so big that they are very, very dense in the center, so dense that the nucleons overlap, and therefore, again, the individual bags of quarks break down.
Black holes? Have
once you have a black hole, we don't really know what's going on there. That's right. But a pre-black hole star would become a quark gluon plasma before it collapses completely, yes.
You mentioned just now that you're doing this with two gold particles.
For example.
Okay,
yeah.
So, I mean, there's nothing special about gold. It could be two leads, two iridiums.
Gold, in the U.S., we tend to do gold. In Europe, at CERN, they tend to do lead. This is there's not very much difference.
Right.
But the idea is it should be big.
Right.
As big as possible.
So the question is then, when you do this collision and you get this plasma,
yeah.
Right, and this plasma is full of all
right.
sorts of things.
Right.
When you cool that down,
right,
I mean, is this an experiment mm-hmm. people did? Do you start to see the formation of new elements?
Well, this is a very key point exactly, because you have this plasma of quarks and gluons, and of course the whole thing is very hot and it expands, it explodes, so then it starts to cool down, and then the quarks have to find partners because they have to form hadrons again. This means nucleons, mesons, and so on. And you get a lot of new kind of mesons coming out. They usually are unstable, but there's lots of speculation about making new kinds of elementary particles in such a way because it's like a big melting pot. Now, you don't make new elements in this way because it's way too hot for that. So if you want to make new elements, you have to go to very, very low energies. And this is a field that Berkeley was the leader in for many years with Glenn Seaborg and so on. You shoot at very low energies, so you just barely make the nuclei touch, and then you hope they will fuse together to make a bigger nucleus. But it's difficult because, as I said in the beginning, the electric force repels the two, so they don't really like to fuse. But that's the way you have to do it. And then just have to sit and wait and do it again and again until you finally succeed. So it's a very tedious game to make new elements nowadays.
What are your personal scientific goals at the moment? You were just talking about what your particular niche in this area is. What is the big burning question that you're asking yourself?
Well, I mean, you tend to work on certain things, and it's always, what should I say, small steps all the time, something more to be learned. It is rare, I think, that you make a really earth-shaking discovery, but you make progress. I have tended to work a little bit in different areas simultaneously, and this is somewhat related to my peculiar background, that I studied one thing for my PhD, but something entirely different when I came to Berkeley, and I sort of been working in these different areas. So nowadays I work partly on this question with the high-energy heavy ion collisions, and we are trying to find out the so-called phase transition between normal matter, where everything is in the hadrons, that means the nucleons and the mesons and so on, and then the deconfined phase where you have the quark-gluon plasma. There is expected to be a phase transition, and by doing these collisions I described, you can learn about this phase transition.
So a plasma that we were just talking about, you term that a deconfined environment.
Mm-hmm,
that's an interesting expression. I mean, right. Americans and scientists in general, this nomenclature that we dream up, deconfined.
Well, yes, this is because the quarks are usually confined to be within the in the nucleon. They cannot get out. But by compressing many nuclei together, you can deconfine them so that they are kind of roam in a larger volume. So that's a very important term. So it is a phase transition between confined and deconfined.
And that's an element of the energy that the plasma...
Yeah, and in the universe, it went the other way around. You had it deconfined in the beginning because everything was so hot. And then as it cooled, the quarks found their way to become confined in individual nucleons, right?
Okay, we're talking about matter in the universe. Mm-hmm. Well, there is a big puzzle now. What's dark matter?
Yeah, that is a big puzzle. And it's a good point to remember because, the Higgs particle, as we talked about, completes the standard model, but the standard model has nothing to say about dark matter. So it's not a complete model. The model is complete, but it has lots of things it does not explain. We don't know what dark matter is at all.
Are we sure there is such a thing? I mean, are there any people at your level who say, wait a minute, we've done something wrong?
No, I think it is fairly well established. It's not my field either. But I think the original reason for believing that there is something there is just from gravitation because,
the universe is expanding.
The galaxies spin around and you can see how fast they spin, and this cannot be explained by the mass we see. There must be more mass to hold it together, spinning at the rate they do. I think this was the original evidence for it. Now there are many other evidences.
Well, when I was in graduate school, this was all figured out. We had an oscillating universe. It went out and it came back. It went out and it came back.
Right.
And now we know that the universe is expanding.
Yeah.
And I always thought as a kid, well, if the universe is just a vacuum, as the particles got away, wouldn't they speed up?
And?
That's what they're doing.
And so your intuitive ideas are correct.
Well, the thing is right now...
My point in asking the question of Ewan was the fact that we rely so much on theoreticians to explain the natural world, the physical world. And somehow that mathematics is elegant and beautiful in itself. And people therefore believe. But is there some fundamental error that we've ever made? Is that possible?
But I would say that there's an important aspect to it that you should keep in mind, that you have the theory or the theorists to try to make sense out of the data we have. And you use the mathematics to make elegant models. But then, very importantly, you use that to make predictions for phenomena we have not yet observed, for new experiments to verify or falsify your model. That's very important. It's not just you believe it because it's an explanation. It's very important with the empirical testing whether it's correct or not. And then when you have tested it enough, well, then you feel confident you can believe the model within its realm of validity. So that's a very important element.
Well, I mean that's the whole business of the experimentalist, right? I mean
exactly, but that's right. It's not like it's really not a question of authority like it is in so many other areas of life where a big authority says something and you must believe it.
Right.
This is empirical and nature. As Feynman said, you cannot fool nature.
No, but you can fool people.
You fool yourself.
Right, you fool. Yeah. Exactly. And so there are quite often people who do experiments.
But there is a consequence to this. Yeah. A theorist that makes a prediction, and all of a sudden somebody has to build a $3 billion machine to prove it.
Yeah, it doesn't happen so suddenly. I just heard yesterday, now at CERN, you probably heard about in Europe, this big accelerator center that the Europeans have together. Now that they have found the Higgs, what's next? And they have started the study group. And they're talking about a timescale of 20 years to find out what's next.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Ewan Randrup from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. It's been a lot of fun listening to you talk about this very, very complex area that we know less than we think we know, that's for certain.
Thanks for being here, and thanks to our producer, Belinda Fernandez.
And also thank Norma Martinez, who does all the cutting and pasting to make this come out like a very, very professional program. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Take care.